As a doctor, I can't tell you how often I recommend people use natural honey, natural, organic, locally produced honey from local honeybees as a means of staving off allergies and promoting good health. And I myself use honey pretty much every morning. So I understand the importance of having good bees, because without good bees, we wouldn't have good honey. And today we have someone who understands bees even better. This is Christy Hemenway. She is the founder of Gold Star Honeybees, a company that creates a low-tech natural beekeeping system known as the Top Bar Hive, which allows bees to make their own natural beeswax honeycomb. Christy is also the author of The Thinking Beekeeper, a guide to natural beekeeping in top bar hives, and a strong advocate for understanding the interrelatedness of bees, human health, and the health of the planet. Thanks for coming in today, Christy.
Thank you for having me.
Christy, the first time that I heard of you or of Gold Star Honeybees, you were giving a TEDx talk in Portland, TEDx Deer Ago, and you were talking about something that was kind of scary, colony collapse disorder, and how this is related to really the health of all of us.
Indeed it is. My favorite quote by John Muir addresses that by saying that if you tug on one thing in nature, you're going to find that it's attached to everything else. Nothing will bring that point home to you like being a beekeeper, where you suddenly start to see just how connected everything is. Without bees, no food. Without or with using the pesticides and toxic stuff on the food that we eat, you're affecting the bees. Anything that goes on with the air or the soil or the water is all connected.
So what is colony collapse disorder, and why is this something that your average person, say me, should care about?
Well, colony collapse disorder, which we refer to as CCD, is the name we gave to the phenomenon that started to happen late in 2006, where a commercial beekeeper by the name of Dave Hackenberg from Pennsylvania had gone to a bee yard where he had about 400 hives resting in Florida, and they were boomers, just really big, thriving hives. And 2 to 3 weeks later, he went back to visit that same bee yard and found that only 36 of those colonies were still alive. Now, okay, so that sounds like a sad, lots of bees died story, but in fact, it's even stranger than that, because colony collapse disorder leaves you with a hive that is not full of dead bees, it's simply empty. And that's extreme in another way, because if you know a little bit about bees, you know that they sting, and they sting for two very important reasons: to defend brood, which is a fancy word for baby bees, and to defend their food stores, which is their honey. And so for them to fly off and disappear and leave behind in these colony collapse disorder affected hives brood and food is really strange. It's also very difficult to study something when you don't have the dead bodies. And it's not like you're going back to these hives and finding the dead bodies. The bees have disappeared. And that's just, you know, weird on a really deep level. Really strange phenomenon. So they've been looking ever since 2006 for a one-to-one cause and effect relationship there, and began to learn that that's just not how nature works. Everything is connected, and so there's more to look at than just, is there a bug or a pest or a disease that's causing this? Because my favorite phrase was one of the researchers that said that that was a pretty naive way for them to look at it. It's definitely connected to a lot of other things going on in the environment, and that's where they've started to sort of broaden their view, you might say.
Bees are important in no small part because they are pollinators and because they make it possible for lots of other crops to grow, thrive. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we all realize that.
If you want to put it in a really graphic way, and sometimes a little too much information sends the point home, bees are how plants have sex. They can't get up and walk around and go and meet and greet each other, so the bees do that for them. Now, we call it pollination, but it's how plants like zucchini, for instance, peas, green beans, the things that grow in your garden, flowers, trees, herbs, all of those things, it's how they reproduce. Pollen has to be moved from one flower of that species to another. And so that's what happens when a bee gets on there and bumps up against the pollen and then gets on another plant of the same type and bumps up against the organs, if you will, of that plant. That's how we get more plants. That's why we joke about You know, how many times have you had to lock your car to keep your neighbor from leaving the bag of zucchini on your front seat because, you know, it's how we make more zucchini, if you will. So that's the biggest reason that it matters is, I mean, honey is good and great. And as you mentioned, it's good medicine, good allergy medicine and stuff. But if we didn't have something pollinating the plants, we wouldn't be getting the fruits and the vegetables. And pretty soon that would turn into a food shortage. And, you know, that way lies madness.
Why did you become interested in bees? What was the path?
Well, I actually came into beekeeping through the alpaca business. And before I owned Gold Star Honeybees, I ran Gold Star Alpacas, and I was a herd sitter. So I wanted to be able to offer more services than just herd sitting. So I went to a farm out in Waldoboro and learned how to shear. And after I had wrestled with this farmer about a half a dozen alpacas into some fairly bad haircuts, he reached over into a ledge in his barn and picked up a jar and handed it to me and said, "Here, thanks for your help." And I said, "You're more than welcome. What is this?" And the jar was full of honey that he had harvested straight out of his own hives and just strained it and put it in the jar. But it was so nearly unrecognizable from what you're used to seeing in the grocery store, which is so very, very clear and runny and, you know, fairly processed honey. And this was just literally straight out of the hive, no more straining than it takes to get the wax out and maybe the occasional spare bee part. So I was pretty enthused at that point and wanted to know more. And since he was also tied up with the Knox Lincoln County beekeepers, he got me started into bee school. And the next thing you know, I was in conventional hives, the square box hives that people are mostly familiar with, but there were a few things about it that didn't really ring true, and the first one was the way the bees made their honeycomb. And I was dying to see what they did before all the inputs that us humans have been giving them in these square boxes, and when I saw just naturally made honeycomb that I pulled out of a colony that was living in a roof line, that you might say that rocked my world. It just changed my whole attitude about it because the bees are doing something very different than what we're asking them to do inside a commercial hive. So that got me interested in anything that had to do with natural beeswax, and that brought up eventually a couple months of Googling was what it took at the time because it was not that prevalent. But that's what brought the idea of top bar hives to my attention, and soon I was running a service where, say you wanted to have bees, but you didn't want to necessarily be a beekeeper. That's what Gold Star Honeybees did. We put a hive on your place. It didn't move. It was not migratory pollination, but it stayed at your place, and I, as the beekeeper, traveled to care for it, sort of like the pool guy. You know, if you have a pool, the pool guy comes and cares for it. And so that's how I started out. That made it apparent to me in big letters that you had to have interchangeable parts. All of your equipment parts needed to be interchangeable. And that sort of lit the light bulb that said, that means these should be a kit. And so I went from running a beekeeping service, essentially, to manufacturing the equipment. And, of course, I wrote a book about how to do it and teach classes and working on making that class available electronically to all and sundry as well.
Yes, you're doing a Kickstarter campaign.
Kickstarter campaign, yes. Starts on the 10th, runs for 21 days, which we thought was appropriate because that's about how long it takes to make a baby honeybee, a worker bee. And yeah, we're really excited. There's been a lot of people that have been very supportive of the idea, but not everybody can come to Maine to go to bee school. And I've traveled a lot to teach this class, but I can't get to everybody where they live. So this will make that a whole lot easier and help people feel more confident about being able to keep bees in this natural method.
When you think about honeycomb and you think about what bees do to sort of build their hives, you've described what we offer them commercially, which is some sort of piece of, I guess, is it usually plexiglass or some sort of?
Well, it comes in a couple of different forms. What you're talking about is called foundation, and it's generally a piece of plastic, sometimes a very thin and flexible piece, or sometimes much more rigid, coated with wax. And the interesting thing to me about foundation is that it has hexagons embossed on it, as if bees don't understand how to make hexagons, which is a little bit laughable since they're sort of like the original engineers. So I really looked at that, and I looked at natural comb when I had pulled it out of a building and said, wait, there's a huge difference here. First being that foundation is all one size. Natural beeswax, they need to make different sizes for different things. Girl bees or workers are born in one size cell. Drones are born in another size cell, much bigger. A drone bee is a bigger bee. And the bees need to be in charge of that. You know, honeycomb, I've described it as being the heart and the skeleton of the bee colony. And the bees really need to be in charge of where what is put and making it to based on what's going on with their system inside the hive.
Also, what we're giving them to build on top of is of great concern.
Mm-hmm. It is. When we started in the middle 80s with a pest problem called the Varroa mite, we took sort of a zero tolerance attitude about the Varroa mite, and we started to treat hives with some pretty strong chemicals. And of course, after a couple of years of treating them with strong chemicals, the mites by this time developed a resistance, so we moved on to a second chemical. So a couple more years of treating with that, we had a resistance problem, but in the meantime, beeswax is what they call lipophilic, so it absorbs these chemicals, and now you have not only that first chemical, but essentially a chemical cocktail inside the hive, and then eventually this wax that's absorbed all this persistent pesticide is sent away to be melted down and made into new foundation. And the problem with that is those chemicals don't just magically disappear out of the wax, they're still in there, and when you buy brand new foundation today, the wax is already contaminated. So even in a brand new beehive using foundation, you're starting out with a contaminated situation inside your hive.
So how does this impact us as humans?
Boy, we would like to have more data on that, wouldn't we? Well, it can't be good, first of all, and it means that the honey that we would like to use for healthful purposes is contaminated to a certain extent with this stuff that's been used to treat for mites. And anything else that a bee goes out and encounters in the field and brings back, which also goes into the wax and honey and everything that's in the hive. So it really is a way of contaminating lots of stuff sort of all at once. You bring it back into the hive and everything that's in the hive is now got what the bees have been foraging on and anything that for instance, if you look out at the world and you see a green growing thing, really of any kind, especially if it flowers, the thing I like to think of purposely is that that's bee food. And so if you leave it alone and clean and pristine as bee food, then you've got a much safer situation than if you get into a situation where you're concerned about other pests destroying a crop, because that's where you're taking all that stuff right back in the hive. You can't really control where the bees are flying. You can't say, no, don't go over there. That's bad stuff. They don't know, and they get involved with that stuff, and in the hive it goes.
So when I'm buying something that labels itself as organic honey, how do I know that it's actually organic? If the bees are flying wherever they want, and maybe they're going over to Farmer Brown's crops, and they're all organically created, but they're going over to Farmer Joe's crops and Farmer Joe is using pesticides, how do we know this is organic?
Chances are good. If you look carefully at the honey that you're buying, you're going to find very, very few labels that say organic on them. They will say pure. They might say raw. They might say natural. Probably all these glowing terms. And of course, we think of honey as this perfect food, and it really is an amazing thing. But it's almost impossible to have organic honey unless you've got control over well over 100 square miles. A bee can fly 5 miles from a beehive, and so if you took, let's say for instance, I know the radio audience can't see this, but if this was my beehive and I had a 5 mile long piece of string and I drew a big circle with that string, that's the area that your bees can forage in. So unless that is all certified as organic, then it's not organic honey. Could be that the beekeeper didn't use any kind of chemicals in their hives, but still what they're foraging on is what the honey's made of. And so that's the key. That's what has to be organic. It's not something that we think of right away because, we do have this good feeling about honey. It's a beautiful food and pure and natural, and all of those words seem to say, oh, it's good stuff, but it's rarely, if ever, is it actually USDA certified organic because of the forage that the bees are bringing it back from.
Christy, your book is called The Thinking Beekeeper, A Guide to Natural Beekeeping in Top Bar Hives. And by the way, for those who are listening, it's been a recommended book by Mother Earth News, which those of us who read magazines know that this is a very good, Mother Earth is a very well-known publication. So congratulations on that stamp of approval.
Thanks. I was proud of that.
But what is a top, tell me, what is the top bar hive give people who are beekeepers or non-beekeepers? What does it do for us?
The most important thing about a top bar hive is that the bees get to make all of their own natural beeswax honeycomb. There's no foundation used, and so that means when you look at a top bar hive, it is a series of bars that sit across a top of a cavity where the bees are nesting, and they draw honeycomb down from each individual top bar. And the difference really between that and the conventional hives with a sheet of foundation inside it is that they're drawing it with cell sizes that suit the purposes that they're going to use it for. When they're beginning a hive, they need to make lots and lots and lots of baby bees. So the comb is called brood comb. It's not necessarily honeycomb right off the bat. And that means you've got to be prepared for the size of the babies that are going to be born. Worker bees are the girl bees in a hive, and there's a bunch of them, and they're a little smaller than the boy bees or the drones. The bees have to make the cells a different size for those baby bees to be, the eggs to be laid in and the larvae to hatch out of. And so it's all kind of going on based on what the bees know about what they need to be having in the hive, and they start out with building that brood nest. So lots of girl bees, some drone bees, and then eventually they'll change it over to honey. And that can be just about any size. It can be a cell that's big around. It can also be a cell that's very deep. So, but really the important part of that is that the bees know a whole lot more about it than we do, and it needs to be under their control. I mean, it is really the heart and skeleton of the bee colony, and they're the only people who, or the only bugs that have any idea what they need to have next.
And honey is usually used for their purposes to actually feed their babies.
Right. That's what honeybees eat in the winter. They make honey while the sun shines for those times when there is no sun. Like, we got sun today. But we have sun today, but we don't have flowers. So that's what they're basically doing, is getting themselves through the winter on their own resources.
We've heard about bees in other contexts. For a while, I think there was some concern about the killer bees that were coming from in other countries. And you know, I think many of us have fears about, you know, bees that sting. But this is maybe not as well, tell me about the significance of the killer bees, and should we worry about stinging?
Okay. Killer bees is a concern, yes, but not, it shouldn't be an overblown concern. A killer bee is essentially what we call an Africanized honeybee. And the difference between an Africanized honeybee and what we usually think of as a honeybee, it's a European honeybee, is that they are, first of all, they're usually from a warmer climate, so they have less concern about this idea of storing up food to get through the winter. So they tend to be swarmier, meaning that they just swarm off and reproduce more quickly, but they are also more defensive and just nastier temperament, and so they do sting more. You can manage Africanized bees or killer bees, but it's not as fun as a European honeybee, which has a tendency to be a lot more mellow, easy to get along with. But, you know, I mean, who can pass up a good Stephen King novel, right? Killer bees, it's very sensational. And it can be a problem. I mean, especially if a person were allergic and you were to get attacked by an Africanized hive of bees, you know, that's a life or death matter. It's totally frightening. But typically, being stung is not a life-threatening event unless you have an anaphylactic allergy. You should feel it. It should hurt. It should turn red. It should probably swell a bit, and it should itch. I mean, it's venom. It's meant to make you want to go away. You know, bees aren't really happy about you being in their hive, so stinging you is their way of repelling you. But it's not a real big deal unless you are still, like, unaccustomed to it or have never been stung, and then it's a big, scary thing. I think by the time you get past your first one or two or three stings as a beekeeper, you're kind of like, yeah, so what? You know, you really don't care. It's not that big a deal. Like I said, it's to be taken seriously in the case of an anaphylactic reaction, but most people are not actually allergic. They say that the percentage of people who have an anaphylactic allergy to honeybee venom is about 2% of the population. So it's not all that widespread.
So people who get a local reaction to a honeybee sting, it's because that's what's meant to happen typically.
It goes on the list of things that are supposed to happen, yes. That's exactly normal.
We're seeing more of an interest in people raising their own chickens, even inside the city limits, and beekeeping. This has become more and more popular. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the first reason is because bees and chickens are each other's gateway drug. But I think there's been a movement sort of to get a little better connected to the planet. You know, we don't necessarily like the pictures that we've been shown of factory farming. Chickens raised in an environment like that don't look healthy or cheerful, and you just don't really want to be connected to that or perpetuating it. And so people found that it was fairly easy to lobby your local government and be able to keep chickens, and bees are somehow in that same vein. Obviously, there's a huge difference between chickens and bees, but they're related in that you can do it in your backyard, and it's not as intensive as having a cow, say, which requires a lot of space. And so it seems to just go hand in hand. And the other thing that I will say that I've found, when I started first marketing Top Bar Hive and talking about the concept, I would have mothers, always mothers, it seemed, come up to the hive with a child in each hand, and she'd be, "Johnny, Susie, look, it's bees." And then she would look at me and she would say, "We just got chickens, and next we're getting bees." Because it's just a way of parents helping to teach their children, look, this is how the world works, this is where food comes from, this is important stuff, you should know this. And especially when you can compare it to video game playing, it's a great deal more earthy, you might say.
And this was the way that things used to work. I mean, people would have a farm, they would have some chickens, they'd have a cow, they might have a beehive out back. I mean, this was a way that people had and to sort of create self-sustainability.
Agreed. And somewhere we kind of got disconnected and came off track there, and agriculture started to blow up into a big industry instead of something that you did in your backyard, and bees kind of got to be considered something that were meant for the country, essentially, and so you didn't necessarily have a lot of people keeping bees in urban or suburban places, and that was all to the detriment of everybody's backyard vegetable garden. You know, it used to be perfectly normal that if you gardened, you had bees. It was just kind of part and parcel. And when that came apart, it left us with a world where you could plant a garden all day long and not necessarily get anything out of it. Because if there were no bees, there was no pollination, and now we have no zucchini. Which, I mean, I could probably live in a world without zucchini, but, you know, I'm very big on every other vegetable on the planet, so, you know, you need all of that to work. And somehow, when that came unplugged or disconnected, we just sort of lost track of it and started to think that maybe chicken really did come in styrofoam trays wrapped in cellophane. You know, it's kind of, there's a movement to change that back, and I think that's one of the reasons that parents are interested in chickens and bees.
What would the requirements be for somebody who wanted to keep bees? Say I live in Portland on the West End and I have a little plot of land to go along with my house. Like, how much space do you need? You know, what are some of that requirements, and how much work is it?
Good questions for people who are getting started, for sure. You don't necessarily have to have a lot of land yourself, because, as we talked about earlier, bees forage easily 5 miles from their hive, so they're going to be out in the area to the tune of about 100 square miles surrounding your place. But you don't have to have that whole you don't have to own all that acreage, and you don't have to have it all planted with everything that the bees need to eat either. So you need to be in a good place. The less pesticide use and industrial agriculture in your area that there is, the better. But they just need a place where it's safe for the hive to be, and the traffic of the bees coming in and out of the hive needs to be somewhat secluded. I mean, you don't want the bees coming out of the hive and going straight across your sidewalk so that the mailman has to walk through them to get to the mailbox. That's kind of out. But just, you know, a safe enough place where the hive isn't bothered, and then enough good forage in your area that they've got the food that they need.
And how much work does it take to actually maintain these hives?
What I like to do is take the whole season and then average it out by the week. And so I think that early on you probably inspect once a week, maybe a little more often than that. You're certainly out there excited about your bees, so you're looking. And at the beginning, you're new, perhaps, and so you're not as confident and you're not as quick. So an inspection will probably take you 45 minutes to an hour. And then as the season progresses, you're going to find that you get a little faster, a little more confident, it goes a little better, but your colony is now considerably larger as well. So it seems to work out to about an hour an inspection, no matter what. So If you were to look at that chopped out over your entire growing season, from the minute you put a brand new package of bees into a brand new hive to the time you close down in the winter, it's probably a little less than an hour a week. Or like we like to say, less than chickens. So, but an hour a week, if that. You don't have to look at them every day. You don't have to do anything with them every day. Just keeping tabs on their health. In a top bar hive, an important thing to be aware of is you have to be sure that they're drawing the wax straight. It has to be on each individual bar because you need to be able to pick up each individual bar to inspect it. And if they happen to glue or wax, if you will, stick some bars together by the way they've made the wax, then you need to get in there and correct that situation so that you can inspect each individual bar.
So when you say drawing the wax straight,
that's a hard concept, isn't it? It essentially means this. Bees start at the top of the cavity and they cluster. When they're drawing wax, it's also called festooning or chaining in the case of drawing wax. And they're hanging down from each other, holding hands like you wouldn't believe. I mean, they're just like grabbed onto each other. They secrete tiny little wax globs out of glands that are in their abdomens. And they grab those, chew them up, and they stick them to whatever's above. And then they stick another one to that, and another one to that, and another one to that. So it's all wax made right out of their little bee bellies, but it's all gravity-based. And the thing that the beekeeper really wants is for each piece of comb to be drawn straight down from a top bar. Now, that's one of the reasons that foundation was put into use, because if you aren't patient with the drawing of the wax, then it means you might be in there having to correct a problem that will slow you down. And as a commercial beekeeper, you may not have the luxury of that much time to let them do that keep it so that it's inspectable. But in a top bar hive, it's pretty important that they be doing that on their own, and so it matters that the beekeeper be what we call a wax shepherd. You need to be in there shepherding the drawing of the wax so that it's something that you can inspect.
And is this much of a financial commitment to decide to own bees?
Well, the bees themselves, it depends very much on what you want to do there. If you were to get bees from me, you'd find yourself, if you picked them up from me at Gold Star Global Headquarters, as we like to call it here in Maine, they're $150 for what's called a 3-pound package that comes with a queen. 3 pounds of bees is about 10,000 bees. It's enough bees to start a new hive, and the queen that comes with it is all part and parcel, and that's how they get started. And then hive equipment, what I try to do with the products that Gold Star offers is hit several different price points that are tied to your interest and ability as a woodworker, or your amount of available free time, or your amount of available free money. Because if you don't have any time, then the deluxe hive makes sense. It's all in there. It's painted. The roof is painted. The observation window is already installed. And all you have to do is have a screwdriver and a staple gun, take it from the box, and in 2 hours, voila, there it is. But if you like to woodwork, and you can, and you've, you know, got the kind of equipment and that sort of interest in it, then for $50, the do-it-yourself kit builds the exact same hive, but you get to do all the woodworking. And then in between, because the top bar itself in a Gold Star hive is the most important thing about getting straight wax, it's got a great guide on it, but it's milled out of one piece, and not everybody has the equipment that makes that easy. It's not necessarily safe to do it on a table saw, and we like beekeepers to have all 10 fingers. Counting to 10 is a good thing in our world, but the do-it-yourself number 2 kit that I offer has all the top bars in it, and the beekeeper gets to build the stuff that's a little less labor and equipment intensive. So $295, and you've got the important piece and the ability to build the rest of the hive. So really, it's a mix. Time, money, woodworking, what do you want to do? What makes you happy?
How can people find out about Gold Star Honeybees and the work that you're doing and the instruction that you're offering and the Kickstarter campaign?
Well, first stop would be go to www.goldstarhoneybees.com. From there, you can get to just about everything else. There's a YouTube channel also. If you go to YouTube and you simply search for Gold Star Honeybees, there's over 50 how-to videos on how to do this and that in your hive, tips and tricks for getting through winter, how to start up a hive, all of that sort of thing. And of course, when the Kickstarter launches next Monday, there'll be a link to that there too. So the classes, I have to say that my passion really is talking about bees. I love to teach the classes, but to teach for a weekend in front of, you know, a class size of 25 to 50 people just isn't getting the word out fast enough. And so we're really excited about Kickstarter making it so that anybody that wants to learn how to keep bees in a top bar hive can sit down and do it, get the information.
Well, I encourage people who are listening who might have an interest in beekeeping or just an interest in bees to go to your website and learn more. I appreciate the work you're doing, bringing a more natural way of beekeeping to Maine and to hopefully other parts of the country. And I appreciate your coming in today. We've been speaking with Christy Hemenway of Gold Star Honeybees and also author of The Thinking Beekeeper.
Well, thank you for having me in.